So we're back with our interview now with Bruce Levine. He's a clinical psychologist and he's the author of a book with a fantastic title called The Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life from Drugs, Shrinks, Corporations, and a World Gone Crazy. Hello, Bruce.
Good to be on.
Thank you very much for being here. So I'm always very interested in people's journeys and how they get to the places that they get to. So I'm just wondering, as a psychologist, how you came to write this book and came to, well, maybe you can explain as well what it's about.
Well, a lot of it is about just sort of debunking a lot of the pseudopsychiatry, the lack of science behind not only these diagnoses, invalidity and diagnoses, unreliability of diagnostic procedures, ineffectiveness of treatments, but it's a lot more than that. It's also talking about society. And something that psychiatrists and psychologists have really woefully failed to do, which is to talk about just what a great impact culture and society has on our mental well-being. And what they've rather, you know, focused on are sort of phantom biochemical explanations, phantom genetic explanations. And, you know, why I wrote this book was that, you know, over the years, I've been increasingly embarrassed by my profession. When I was an undergraduate in psychology, there were folks in my profession, there were people to be impressed by. There were people like Eric Fromm, and there were folks who were talking about culture, society, and its relationship to emotional difficulties. And that just kind of just fell off the map with the advent of pharmaceutical companies really kind of taking over the profession, and which happened in the 1980s, and nowadays they really almost have merged pharmaceutical companies and the American Psychiatric Association and some of these so-called consumer groups in the States. It's the National Alliance of Mentally Ill. I guess in Canada there's something similar, like I think it's the Canadian Mental Health Association, and all of these sort of forces have just kind of merged in a kind of partnership and have just kind of got people to stop using their common sense. And that's part of why I wrote this book. And so I talk about the ineffectiveness of treatments. Many people out there, psychiatric treatments, the drug treatments, electroshock, and even some of the simplistic behavioral manipulations have failed dramatically. And it's important for these people to know that they have not failed treatment, but that maybe treatment has failed them. And also to begin to understand that there's lots of cultural, political forces out there that psychiatrists and psychologists really are not going to talk about, that are really the major reason why they're having some difficulties out there.
I guess if you have an organization or like pharmaceutical corporations that are basically running the show or becoming very powerful in the mental health industry, you have a strong motivation from them to have people on drugs and to therefore have as many different psychoses and diseases out there as possible, or to even create new ones that don't exist.
Right. I think you don't have to, I think it's not necessary to be cynical. I mean, it's just necessary to be realistic that what do corporations do? Their goal is to expand their markets, very simply.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very simply what they're going to do. And to the extent that a profession allows themselves to kind of be partnered up with, I mean, that's what they're going to do. Their responsibility is to the shareholders. Many of them are their CEOs and the executive board themselves. But I mean, their responsibility is for growth, for more income. And what better way to do that than to have more and more diagnoses, to convince more and more people that, you know, basic, you know, kind of normal human processes are really psychiatric diseases? What better way than to convince folks that the easiest way to fix these things are taking psychotropic drugs, which are, by the way, in many ways very, very similar to illicit drugs, and so that's what you do if you're a corporation. You expand your markets, and that shouldn't sound cynical to people. That should just sound like common sense.
Hi, Doctor. That says I'm James. I'm Julie's co-host.
Hi, James.
thanks again for joining us. This is a really very exciting. Can you talk a little about so-called chemical imbalance? I hear this over and over again, especially from friends of mine who are or were taking antidepressants like Paxil or Prozac and things like that. They say, you know, hey, I would love to be able to not take these, you know, but I have a chemical imbalance. And
First of all, there's no proof that any chemical imbalance is related to any kind of psychiatric disorder. Let's take depression because that's probably the most famous chemical imbalance. Who in North America and much of the world hasn't heard that, you know, you have a deficit of serotonin and that's why you're depressed? Mm-hmm. And the reality is there's absolutely no scientific evidence of that. Let me just give you a couple of things. I don't want to bog your audience down with facts. We can move to just sort of common sense understanding why this can't be true, but just a couple of facts. As early as 1998, a pretty mainstream textbook, the American Medical Association's Essential Guide to Depression, says quite clearly, actually, I can tell you, I've memorized this because this question comes up a lot, page 64 of this book, it'll tell you right clearly there's no relationship between serotonin levels and depression. In fact, some people who have too much, you know, have more than normal levels of serotonin get depressed, people who have less than normal levels, average levels, there's just no relationship. And another, you know, there's many other pieces of documentation on this, but I can tell folks a couple of other things just to kind of, if they don't want to, you know, kind of go through all the research here or even look at my book and they don't want to do any of this, you just go to your doctor and ask your doctor what's the lab test for my depression or any other of these psychiatric disorders. We can measure the amount of serotonin in the body. Why don't they use it, especially here in the States? If some of your listeners are listening to the States, you know they're not adverse to using any kind of expensive test in the world if, you know, they can back it up. And they won't use it because the science is that there is no relationship. There's actually some interesting studies done in the mid-90s where they depleted serotonin in people through what they gave them certain kinds of food that depleted the serotonin, and it didn't matter in terms of their depression. It didn't cause depression in people who were undepressed. It didn't get people who were more, you know, who were depressed even more depressed. So there's just really no evidence of that. And just one other kind of common sense thing on this for folks is that nobody in all of establishment psychiatry will disagree with the fact that there's been this huge increase in the rate of depression in America. In fact, the common statistic is a tenfold increase in the last 50 years of depression. In fact, if you take a look at any psychiatric disorder, there's these huge, gigantic, increases of this. And it's just common sense tells you our biochemistry and our genes don't change in a generation or two. And so if there's these huge increases, the obvious place to look is what is changing dramatically, which is our society and our culture.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you believe causes depression, or what do you think might be an alternate explanation?
Well, I think there's a lot of different explanations. One of the really more interesting studies, which everybody should know about, but of course drug companies and the media that they control are not real interested in having folks aware of this, was a study that was done with many thousands of subjects in 1998 by a guy named Vega, a professor of public health. And what he did was he compared Mexican immigrants to Mexican Americans. What he found was this huge increase in mental difficulties for Mexican immigrants if they'd been over in if they were here in America for more than 13 years, or, you know, if they were Mexican Americans first generation. So you had about twice the rate of mental illness of folks who are who were here for extended period of time compared to recent Mexican immigrants, or compared to those who are still in Mexico. And with respect to depressive episodes, you have three times the possibility if you're a Mexican and you're here in America for more than 13 years.
Wow.
And so, yeah, you're going to have more TVs and consumer goods, and your hourly wage is going to go up. But yeah, you know, the obvious thing is like, why aren't people asking, like, why is this happening here? And I think one thing that we can kind of we know by the research, there's some things that we can speculate the explanation here, but one thing is just social support. That we have more, we have lots of evidence that those people who are depressed, you know, are isolated, are poor in many cases, but are certainly kind of, you know, isolated people, and people who have, there's far less likelihood, I'm not saying people who have social supports and who have intimate relationships and friendships, you know, they won't get depressed, but there's far less likelihood that they will be depressed. So that's one thing that we've documented, that we know about, that's certainly a much more important variable than any of these kind of biochemical genetic things that we talk about.
So like
there are other variables as well. Some things that folks have talked about, there was a World Health Organization study that was done in the 90s, and it's commonly reported, part of it, but not all of it. What's commonly reported, which is interesting enough, was that depression had become the fourth most devastating illness in the world, and was predicted to rise to second place by 2020. Now, that was in all the major commercial media. But what wasn't talked about was that there was a higher prevalence of depression in consumerist societies and in so-called first world or developed nations. And you know, that's sort of interesting to speculate what that's all about. And you know, one of the speculations is that when you're living in a consumer society, what it's all, you know, geared to is sort of increasing expectations all the time. And what that does is certainly going to often outstrip outcomes. Whatever you're expecting, you know, you're not going to get, and there's going to create some pain, resentment, and depression. So that's another important variable. But I think there are a lot of other variables. I can just keep going on this, but a lot of what I talk about in Common Sense Rebellion are three huge variables, which, in addition to community, which I talked a little bit about already, the lack of that, in when you have industrialized, institutionalized kind of societies we have here, you have a diminished autonomy, and you have a diminished kind of meaningfulness in people's lives. So when you take a look at pre-industrial people, or even 100 years ago, most of North America were still family farmers. You know, you had tougher lives physically. There, you know, I don't want to romanticize the lives of these people, but there was a lot more control over their active lives. They didn't have jobs like we have today. I mean, in the States, the leading growth jobs are cashiers and janitors and clerks and, you know, those kinds of things where there's just, you know, very little autonomy, very little control over your decision making, and There's not a lot of meaningfulness in being a Walmart greeter. I mean, I don't mean to put down people who are forced to do these jobs to make have an income here. You know, but let's, you know, we have to be honest. It's hard to imagine anybody saying, well, this is really meaningful work here. And that's, you know, again, when I first started in the business, and now it's a business. When I first started in the profession 20 years ago, it was not radical at all to talk about these issues. You know, one of the most famous psychiatrists in America, you know, 25 years ago, was a guy named Frankl, Viktor Frankl, who talked about man's search for meaning. This was a pretty mainstream idea that if you had little meaning in your life, you were much more likely to be depressed and even suicidal. He went as far to say is that when he was in the concentration camp, that was a major sort of antidote for folks who didn't make suicide attempts. Most people in concentration camps weren't very depressed. Lots were suicidal. And what he tried to help them do was to somehow figure out a way to have some meaning in their lives to kind of, you know, overcome their, you know, horrific existence there. And so, you know, a lot of these antidotes have been known for many, many years, autonomy, meaningfulness, community, but they've been obliterated by this kind of psychopharmaceutical industrial partnership here.
I really agree with you in the sense of community being something that a lack of it will cause people to be depressed. And I used to live in Southeast Asia, and one of the things that I marvel at now as I look back on it is that most of the people around me, the Indonesian people, were very, very poor and really had nothing. And they were always happy and smiling and talking. And when I would get on a bus there was always on the bus one general conversation going on that everybody was participating in. And often the bus conductor was leading the conversation, and they were laughing and talking about the latest stuff happening politically. And I came back to Canada, And I would ride the bus into work every day, and everybody on the bus was isolated, sitting so close to one another during rush hour, and yet not talking, not even saying hello to one another, you know. And I really think it's a getting to be desperate here, our lack of community North America.
The story that you're telling is you know, lots of folks I talk to, you know, have been to Central America or Southeast Asia or other parts of the so-called, and I have to clearly say so-called, underdeveloped world, because it's really not underdeveloped, and in many ways we are underdeveloped. I mean, we're technologically advanced, and but in terms of basic understanding of human beings and what they need to thrive, we are the underdeveloped culture here in North America. When you take a look at, like, if the goal of your culture and society is to have folks who are pretty, you know, who are smiling and having a good time, we're failing here, and those folks are succeeding.
Mm-hmm. I just want to take a quick moment here to remind listeners that you're listening to Elephant Talk here on CHLY 101.7, and we're speaking with Dr. Bruce, Levine, clinical psychologist and writer of the book Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life
from Drugs, Shrinks, Corporations, and a World Gone Crazy.
Love the subtitle, by the way, and the title.
Yeah,
it's a funny thing, too. I think should give your audience encouragement that even the mainstream media and sort of commercial media and sort of typical mainstream people out there, when they get to the end of that subtitle and they read "And a World Gone Crazy," there's almost kind of universal agreement. It's sort of an interesting thing. Mm. It's like, at some level, it's not just folks who are sort of, you know, self-labeled radicals who think the world's gone crazy. It's most people out there.
Yeah, I agree. I think everybody, we all realize it on some level.
Yeah, we read an article of yours last week called Depathologizing the Spirit of Resistance, and in it, there's a lot of interesting points in it, but in it, you talk about the pathologizing of anti-authoritarianism. Can you speak a bit about that?
Sure. I mean, historically, psychiatry has been used not just by the United States, but all over the world, to pathologize or medicalize folks who are rebelling. And in the early days not too many people in America took it very seriously, but the father of American psychiatry, a guy named Benjamin Rush, I mean, he's actually I call him the father of American psychiatry, because that's what psychiatry has put him on their emblem, and he's a pretty famous guy. I think he's one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence here, so he's a... But one of the interesting things about this fellow Rush was that after the American Revolution, when people were trying to kind of figure out what kind of government this was going to be, whether it was going to be a more sort of centralized government or it was going to be a more decentralized society, he decided to he was for the more centralized government that we've obviously become here, and for folks who were cared a little bit too much, as he described them, had quotes who had too much of a passion for liberty. he labeled them with a disease called anarchia, and I wasn't taken too serious like that. I think even folks like Jefferson, and they'd kind of chuckle, and nobody took too seriously that. And throughout the history of the United States, in the South during slavery, what do you do with slaves who are running away from the plantation? Well, the so-called right, the right wing down there just wants to shoot them, to make an example. The more liberal types down there who want to also keep slavery, you have to pathologize them. So there was a physician in the South in Louisiana called Dr. Cartwright who labeled slaves who ran away as having drapetomania. That's D-R-A-P-E-T-O mania. And slaves who were, and he also had disease labels for slaves who were sort of, not paying sufficient attention to the master's stuff. And then if you go through American history, what happens to Native Americans? Well, again, the right wing wants to just exterminate them outright because they're in the way. But the left, so-called liberals, you can't do that. You just can't kill people. So what we'll do is we'll basically pathologize being an Indian. And so there's a famous phrase from the 1860s all the way through the, been part of the 20th century, kill the Indian, save the child, which is basically pathologizing being an Indian. And I think part of, the karma for America here, and for North America, really, Canada has done this very much similar. Some mm-hmm. of this stuff has gone on in Canada. But the karma is eventually, well, we're going to do that to, our own children, and that's exactly what's happened here with some things like attention deficit disorder and oppositional defiant disorder, which is something that I talk about in that article. Right. And oppositional defiant disorder, for those in your audience who think I'm kind of like making this up, these are modern diagnoses, oppositional defiant disorder, and it came into the DSM, which is the American Psychiatric Association's official diagnostic manual, came in 1980. And oppositional defiant disorder is basically those kids out there who, and this is a quote, who often argues with adults, who often refuses to comply with adult requests or rules, and you get that mental illness diagnosis. And I think the encouraging thing for people out in your audience who are just, maybe shaking their heads and going, my God, what this is awful, is that, again, even the mainstream press, when I go on and I talk on, AM, and I talk to commercial radio and talk to folks and who are just basically your Democrat, Republican kind of characters here in the States here, even they get it. Even they're shocked. Even they're stunned. And so the hopeful thing is that when you have any one of these kind of expansionistic forces, when you have any one of these kind of almost imperialistic forces, whether it's a corporation, a nation, or a kind of psychiatric industry, they're always going to go too far. They're always going to, because they always need to grow, and they always get arrogant, and they never realize there's a certain point where it's like everybody's getting it, that they're ridiculous, and that's sort of a kind of a hopeful thing.
Well, I had to myself read the article in it's in Zed magazine, the article right. that we're talking about. I had to read it twice to make sure that in fact you were in earnest, that these are real. That this stuff is real, that it wasn't sarcastic, because it sounds ludicrous at first gloss when you first read it, and like anarchia and oppositional defiant disorder.
Today, anarchia I'm going to make that clear, that those were at one point diagnoses, anarchia and trypanosomia, but the American Psychiatric Association no longer, they're not pathologizing based on a race or any of those kinds of things. I mean, but oppositional defiant disorder is a current, that is a current disorder and widely used. It's not an arcane, seldom used diagnosis. That's widely used.
Yeah. It's,
and of course, everybody knows about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which for me is just as absurd. There's no, when you in practice, 99.9% of these kids who are getting diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, there's nothing wrong with their brains, nothing biochemically wrong with them. What they are, are kids who can very well pay attention to things that are interesting mm-hmm. for them, but are turned off by school.
It's very interesting. You point this out in the article too, that they, if they're being paid or if it's something that they choose, they can pay attention.
We've done studies. There are studies on these kids who are labeled ADD or ADHD, and when these kids get to choose what their activity is, or the activity is novel or stimulating, or they're simply getting paid for it, they all of a sudden they perform very well. I mean, I've had many of these kids who are labeled with ADD, ADHD, who I ask them what it is that they're interested in. I remember one kid had his baseball card collection, another kid had a coin collection, and not only these kids had fantastic attention for what they were interested in, and actually, what ADD or ADHD was, were these kids were non-compliant in situations where they were not, where they were not interested in something. And so in a sense, these little ODD kids, oppositional defiant disorder, and these ADHD kids were really essentially anti-authoritarians more than they had anything to do with any kind of medical condition. These were the kind of kids, unlike most psychiatrists, psychologists, or teachers, who, when they're not interested in something, don't give their interest to authority. And when they disagree with an authority, they don't act compliantly. And I think part of the problem for a lot of psychologists, psychiatrists, and teachers is they don't realize how excessively compliant they are. And, when you're somebody, when you, to become a professional, especially to become a psychologist, psychiatrist, you've spent a lot of your life, you know, getting A's, which means once in a while, I'm sure you enjoyed the class, but to get straight A's, you know, and to do well as they have to do, there's often a lot of compliance. There's often a lot of doing things, jumping through hoops that they really, you know, they're doing it out of fear. And when they meet a population of people who are not so fear-based, who are not so excessively compliant, it gets them uptight, gets them anxious. And so, they, you know, when shrinks are uptight or anxious, you don't, you know, if you're making a shrink uptight or anxious, there's a good chance you're going to get diagnosed with something.
Well, and as well, like our whole school system is set up in that way that you take a group of people and you choose one of those people as the authority figure. That person faces the class, and we're taught from the time we're 4 or 5 years old to submit to authority. And for 12 years, and if you, like you say, if you go on to be a doctor or a psychiatrist, it's another 8 to 12 years.
Right.
So yeah, it is something that seems strange to a lot of people, this anti-authoritarian tendency, where, you know, everywhere else in society, we just accept that, you know, authority is almost like a natural law.
That's right, and it wasn't like that, you know. And this, you know, people don't realize this compulsory schooling is a very modern idea. I mean, it does not exist. You know, 99.9% of human history, there was no such thing as compulsory schooling, and even up until 100 years ago, it was not that big a deal if folks just learned their ABCs, learned, you know, some arithmetic, and they got out of there. It wasn't that big a deal. And so one of the most important chapters in Common Sense Rebellion, I have chapters on this ADD and this ODD and on depression, but I also have chapters on these major institutions of life, because I talk about this institutional illness web where they interact. So the schools, education are huge, you know, and once you've decided as a society here in America that, you know, that everybody has to graduate not only high school but, you know, college, and you've decided to create these basically standardized standardized places, and human beings are not standardized, and you've decided to have, you know, 25, 30 kids in these classrooms, and they have to sort of like all fit into these things, well, you're going to create havoc. You're going to create a minimum of, you know, a few kids who don't want to be there, who they don't belong there, and it's not because they have any disease, and it's not even because they're unintelligent. Some of these kids who are labeled ODD, ADD, they're super intelligent kids, but they're just not, you know, academics, at least at that point in their lives. I mean, some of these kids go on and they really get excited by reading and a lot of these academic things, but at maybe 8 years old or 10 years old or 11 years old, or, you know, where some of these other kids can, you know, can sit there and, you know, comply and read things that they're not really interested to because they're happy to get, you know, when the teacher smiles and gives them a gold star. A lot of these other kids, it just doesn't mean anything for them. And, you know, what you're done as a culture and society is, you know, what schools and psychiatry have really done. There's nothing about educating folks. It's nothing about mental health. It's about creating, you know, folks who fit in to the greater sort of increasingly institutionalized work life, where more and more jobs are like that. More and more jobs are sort of standardized, kind of meaningless, uncreative, bureaucratic. And so there is a sort of kind of a dysfunctional functionality to the whole thing. But, you know, and at some weird level, it all works. But it doesn't work at a human level. People are breaking down because of this kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the question becomes, like, is our society working for us, or are we being made to fit in to work for the system and the society, basically?
Well, that's the fundamental question, Julie. That's the fundamental question. That's why I wrote the book, because too many professionals, you know, accept this idea that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to, you know, take individuals and mold them into fitting into a society, no matter how dehumanizing that society is. And the great divide among people for, you know, long time has been those people who don't believe that. Those people who believe, look, it's the goal of a healthy society to create niches and nooks and crannies and arenas for all different kinds of people to find a place in, and it just be, and you're not supposed to create an increasingly standardized society and then you know, manipulate and drug and electroshock people to fit into that. You're supposed to do something else. Mm. I mean, I thought the idea of kind of creating a form, you know, a governmental, industrial, professional society that makes people fit into that. I always thought that was called fascism. But you know, you can't use that word today because then you sound like some sort of extremist. You know, you're not allowed to use those kinds of words. And so, you know, I use words like, you know, like anti-authoritarians and authoritarians. It's almost like you have to invent, you know, a new language to talk about some of the same ideas. Otherwise, you're marginalized as some sort of an extremist.
Wow. Can you speak about, like, the pressure to prescribe pharmaceutical drugs?
Well, the pressure, I'm a PhD psychologist, so the pressure on me is not as huge as it is on MD psychiatrists, and that's one of the reasons I became a psychologist rather than a psychiatrist. But the pressure on psychiatrists is ridiculous. I mean, first of all, a lot of these folks, they literally can't if you prescribe medication, you can literally make 3-4 times as much money.
Wow.
as if you don't, you know.
You
can see 4 or 5 people an hour for these medication managements, and rather if you talk to somebody, the amount of money, it's like 3 or 4 times differently. So right off the top there, that should get people worried, you know, that financial, there's very few psychiatrists, there are some, but a rare few, who are going to transcend those kind of economic incentives, to say nothing, you know, of enormous other pressures. I mean, I could give you a couple that sort of upset some people. I won't go through the whole giant list here, but, you know, just a couple recently.
It's upsetting that there's a giant list.
Oh, yeah, there's a giant list here of, like, things that, but I'll just give you some of the highlights of, you know, right now, the psychiatric, their whole training is being sort of funded by pharmaceutical companies. So, you know, almost everything your average psychiatrist is hearing is through drug company money. So Boston Globe just did a story in 2005 about Harvard Medical School's psychiatry department receiving over $6 million from drug companies. And, you know, drug companies, these doctors have to go for continuing education. And so drug companies fund that, and they pay doctors to go there. We have, you know, drug representatives walking in the States here in Canada, I'm sure, as well, walking into doctor's office on a regular basis with, you know, free meals and pressuring them to use their drugs. I mean, so at every level, these psychiatrists, from the earliest days of their medical school education, you have drug representatives hanging around their mailboxes in academic departments, kind of, you know, giving them, you know, Prozac coffee mugs or, you know, free, you know, information. Their journals are filled with advertising from drug companies. And one of the reasons why I became a psychologist was, like, you know, this wasn't the case 20-25 years ago, but that's changed too. What psychologists are now worried about is they want prescription rights for themselves here, and so that's what their professional organizations, the American Psychological Association, these other things, that's what they're spending their time lobbying for, rather than saying, hey, wait a minute, man, this is not the way to go here. So there used to be a more significant divide between psychiatrists and psychologists in terms of their view on people's emotional difficulties. Now it's a political gang battle, you know, for who's going to have prescription rights.
Prescription rights. Sorry, what is that? What do you mean by that?
Prescription rights means, like, only MDs, mostly only MDs, have the right to write prescriptions, and that's where you make the big money. Whereas if you're a PhD, although in certain states in the United States that psychologists with PhDs have won prescription rights, but that's, of course, the American Psychiatric Association is fighting them on that. So the battle, you know, between, you know, psychology and psychiatry is no longer about theories of why people have emotional difficulties and treatments. It's more a money-making battle.
Because one of the for listeners, one of the fundamental differences between psychiatrist and psychologist is the psychiatrist is a medical doctor, as well, right? And then study psychology.
Right.
Is that, yeah?
So how,
that's scandalous.
How do you go about treating people differently than knowing all of this? Like, when you have somebody that comes to you and says, for example, I'm depressed or whatever, how do you go about doing something different?
I think the first thing that you have to recognize with your clinician, which is a little bit different than when you're a journalist. I mean, when you're a journalist, you know, you hope that the truth is going to set people free. And one of the things that you realize when you're a clinician is that a lot of people know the truth. I mean, a lot of people, despite all of this, you know, propaganda of chemical imbalances and on, and you know, they know, you know, that stuff isn't true. But what happens with a lot of people, and you could talk about this on a grand political level, but and also on a personal level, is that people become really demoralized, really dispirited, almost kind of broken. So one of the things that what I'm really thinking about a lot, and it's probably not a bad idea if you care about political activism in general, is to acknowledge that a lot of people are kind of doing unwise things or self-destructive things, not because they're ignorant or certainly not because they're stupid, but because they're just beaten down. They're just completely demoralized. And so one of the things that I'm always thinking about when somebody comes in my office and say they're depressed is, like, how do we kind of, you know, re-energize? How do you get some morale back that to do a lot of the obvious things? Because, you know, it's obvious, and the research proves this and common sense proves this, that there's a lot of obvious things you can do that are antidotes to depression. You know, for example, exercising and finding social support, and there's just a lot of common sense things to do. But when people are so demoralized, they can't do anything. And so one of the things that helps, I think, to just start your road back to get some morale back is to become less alienated from yourself. And by that I mean is once you stop viewing your depression as a disease or a weakness or some source of shame, or, you know, you stop medicalizing it, you know, you become less alienated from yourself. And the key is how you get back strength in life is becoming more whole. It's becoming more accepting of your humanity. And so a huge part of the way of getting your way back here is accepting, like, wow, there's probably an enormous amount of pain in your life. Maybe it's personal pain or a lot of sources of pain that you've tried to shut down that you didn't want to deal with. And that the more that you can accept, you know, a lot of your humanity, that you may not feel happier right away, but you'll have more energy. So that's one kind of key thing. Another thing that happens to people, and you know, this is sort of, again, a lot of these things are personal and political things, is that a lot of reasons why people act unwisely who otherwise know better is fear, just outright fear. And so you'll see people who are enormously skeptical and critical when it comes to nuclear energy or a whole bunch of other kind of corporate ideas, but when it comes to the mental health establishment, they kind of lose their brain. And it's because when they're scared about themselves, and they're scared about loved ones, they're more susceptible to kind of buying things from any authority who comes along. So one of the things that I'm trying to kind of help folks with, and this is through modeling myself and helping them take some risks, is just sort of overcoming fear. And a lot of ways there's some ways that you can do that have to do with just humor, and some of it also is, and this is, again, really anti the whole history of mental health, is having to do with not taking yourself so seriously. You know, the whole history, really, from Freud and the unconscious to behaviorism to now microscopic self-absorption with drugs, is really taking, you know, your pain, your needs, your fears, your emotions seriously. And there's sort of what happens is that, you know, the more self-absorbed that you become, that the more you're going to have symptoms of compulsive behaviors, drinking, drugs, anxiety, depression. And so a huge part of what you're trying to do with a professional is kind of help people break that vicious cycle of taking themselves that seriously. As opposed, you know, you should take your actions seriously. There's a lot of things to take seriously out there, but once you start taking taking certain things too seriously, you know, it's kind of a vicious cycle. And so that's kind of some of the things that I'm thinking about with people. There's some obvious things. Once you got people mobilized, and once you've got people with some energy, you know, then you help them, you know, think a little bit more positively and less self-destructively. There's a lot of kind of more conventional things that you could do that help people. You know, another source of real morale is basic anti-authoritarianism. I don't know about you guys, but when I hear somebody, you know, who has some guts to take on, you know, a authority figure, it's energizing.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the interesting things is like not only is there kind of pathologizing of anti-authoritarianism problematic, but, you know, because you're calling people mentally ill who are just opposing authority, but by not having people having any models of anti-authoritarianism, they lose that kind of energy that comes from being around those kinds of people. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
It totally does, yeah.
That's pretty much what we try to do with this show, is to highlight things that people are doing that are exciting and that are empowering, and, you know, people that are taking control of their lives or their situations and fighting back against disempowerment.
Right. I think sometimes, you know, I've got a lot of information and a lot of tips and a lot of things in Common Sense Rebellion, but I think sometimes when I've given talks to audiences, you know, the thing that becomes most significant is like these guys are looking, you know, people in the audience are looking and says, you're not afraid of these people, you're not afraid of them taking away your license, or you're not afraid of your colleagues being upset with you, you're not afraid of all that stuff, and I'm going, no, not particularly, and just that alone maybe is more important than all the all the knowledge about the fact, you know, that there's no chemical imbalance and all these kinds of things, just the basic attitude of not being intimidated by authority, which, you know, used to be something, you know, that was an American tradition, something to be proud of a couple of hundred years ago, that, you know, but that's gone away here in this culture dramatically, and people have become a much more obedient to authority culture, and I think that's one major source of that list that I was going through before of why people are more depressed.
That is very strange that idea has gone. I mean, you don't even have to go back a couple hundred years. You can go back to the 50s and things like the Wild Ones with Marlon Brando and Rebel Without a Cause. You know, these guys were cult heroes. Not even cult heroes. They were heroes, you know. And but now, yeah, like you say, like everybody, it's kind of cool to submit to authority. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, and it you see that all throughout the art culture. You see that throughout music culture, like mainstream music culture. And it's funny to me that in popular films, there still is this theme of the little guy getting, you know, getting it in the end, or the little guy coming up against some sort of big problem, or maybe there's an investigative reporter or lawyer or something who figures out the truth about something and they get it out in the end, and everyone loves that, the little guy, for doing it. But then that doesn't translate into reality. It seems
right.
That
it's
in reality,
like it's almost like there's this powerful antidote to depression called anti-authoritarianism, and it's been commercialized, and you're only supposed to kind of like enjoy it as an audience. You're not supposed to do it yourself.
Indeed.
That's brilliant.
We're out of time, unfortunately. I wish we could keep talking, but please tell our audience where and how they can get your book, Common Sense Rebellion, because it sounds awesome.
I have a website, brucelevine.net, and there's a link to buy it there. Most bookstores, if they don't have it on the shelves, you can just kind of order, you know, ask them to order it, and they'll order it. For folks who, you know, want to use these different, I suppose, you know, Amazon, I think actually Amazon has it on discount. I mean, I'm not really a big fan of having people buy through those places, but if you like, you make your purchases through the internet. I think last time I looked, there was a nice discount on the paperback of it. So if folks don't have that much money, they could pick it up that way.
We've got some good bookstores here. I'm sure it's somewhere or easily orderable.
Right.
It's Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life from Drugs, Shrinks, Corporations, and a World Gone Crazy.
Yeah.
That's it.
And who is the publisher?
The publisher is Continuum.
Oh, right, right.
Continuum. They're out of New York and London.
It's been great to talk to you.
Okay, I enjoyed it.
And we'll be in touch.
Sounds good.
BruceLevine.net.